I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source, going to school on Taylor Swift in the Harvard course. And all we know is, as her song says, we're enchanted to meet her.
And it was enchanting to meet you.
Taylor Swift comes out of literature, but she's more than a poet or a pop star. Maybe the word is enchanter for the artist who gets it all into a song, who knows the fusion power of sharp words with the right minimum of melody. We're anticipating Taylor Swift's next album, her Tortured Poets Department, coming in April. Stephanie Burt and MJ Cunniff have made a hit course of it all for Harvard undergraduates. Professor Burt, you're well known as a critical gateway to contemporary poetry, and you know your songwriters as well.
If you are Taylor Swift or Joni Mitchell or Prince or yep. Stephen Sondheim, you are writing words to be sung, words that achieve their full emotional and aesthetic effect when they've got a melody and music behind them. That's what songwriting is. It goes back quite far, but that's where we are now. Right now, it is really separate from page-based poetry and from novel writing.
I think I've been in awe of songwriting all my life.
Oh, me too.
George and Ira Gershwin. I mean,
yeah.
Ira, we don't call him an American poet exactly.
We call him a great lyricist because he
absolutely
wrote great lyrics.
And we call Frank Lesser maybe the best of them all. Baby, It's Cold Outside, or Cole Porter.
Sure.
For crying out loud. But what is it that makes a person a lyricist? Do we know, MJ?
I think that probably depends on the songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
I think for Taylor Swift, one of the things that we keep coming back to in the class, and that I think both Steph and I come back to as people, is the relatability of her works. And I don't mean that in a sort of cliche, she's just like us way, but she writes about things that feel both universal and very specific. It's both something broad like love, which most of us have experienced in some form or another, and something specific like, you kept my scarf.
Yeah.
Right.
Or, yeah.
She wears short skirts, I wear t-shirts. She wears high heels, I wear sneakers. Very specific.
That was my karaoke song for years. Yeah.
I love that. I love that. Yeah, we actually talked about that song in class today.
You're on the phone with your girlfriend. She's upset. She's going off about something that you said. She doesn't get your humor like I do.
That is a great early career for Taylor example of the kind of lyric writing that she does. If you're just reading that on a page, it might not seem awesome. But when you hear her sing, You Belong With Me, you have those melodic arcs in your head and they draw your attention to things like, and this is my favorite word in the entire song, is the word with.
Yes.
The point of the song is that a romantic or an erotic relationship, even with, you know, a girl and a guy who are being pretty conventional about it, even in high school, should be a relationship that makes people more comfortable and not less comfortable. It should feel like a friendship plus smooching, not like something that gets in the way of a friendship. And she's saying, you belong with me. And as you hear that chorus a couple of times and find yourself singing it, your attention might move from me, which is where the melody sends you, right? That note that she holds, to you and to belong and finally to with. You don't belong to me. You don't belong to anyone. No one should belong to anyone. You belong with me.
She draws a crowd anywhere now, but what do Harvard undergraduates come wanting to know about Taylor Swift? And what in your course changes their feeling?
You'd have to poll the students. I know what I hope they will come away with, which is three things. One is a deeper and more nuanced appreciation of what Taylor does and what she has done and how she works as a songwriter, as an artist. Two is a set of tools for literary, cultural, and musical analysis that they can apply to other things and to parts of culture, some of which might be quite critical and quite historically aware. And the third is an appreciation for works of art, songs, poems, novels, memoirs, critical essays, that they might not be familiar with before, that they might never have encountered before. Those are three things. If you come away with any one of those things, then I hope the course was a success. But ideally, everybody who's in the course would come away with all three.
I guess I would love for students who already spend a lot of time thinking about their favorite songs or their favorite artists and digging into references and tracking down clues. I would love for those students to know that oftentimes the process of literary analysis is very similar. I would love to show them the skills and the responses that they already are having to art that already makes them qualified to be thinkers and scholars and writers and artists themselves.
Yeah.
I'd like you to take five famous songs of hers and sort of place them in literature. Who are the forebears of this language? Teachers, in a sense, creators of the language she's working with. Starting with, if we may, 15. A teenage nostalgia song in ways, but where's that language coming from, Stephanie?
15 is simultaneously a teenage nostalgia song if you're an adult and you're hearing it. And I know what you're going through. I've been there quite recently song if you are 15 when you are hearing it. And part of the genius of that song is how thoroughly Taylor is placing herself in the point of view of someone who really is experiencing unwanted or scary or exciting attention from older boys and a giant crowd and a new best friend for the first time.
Yeah.
And one of the genius moves that song makes is to change verb tenses and then to change pronouns from you to I as you move through it, so that Taylor is, as it were, guiding you through the experience you can anticipate having if you are starting high school. She is right there. And at the same time as she's right there with you, she's also aspirational. You can have that experience, maybe, but you could also be having a far worse experience in high school than Taylor had. There are worse things than having senior boys give you polite but unwanted attention. For example, they could throw garbage at you. That happens to people. Taylor is giving you both a relatable and an aspirational teenage experience, and then she's being your guide who's been there, who's going to get you through it. And every syllable in that song, 15, works to do that.
One of the several reasons we have Willa Cather on the syllabus is that Song of the Lark is in certain ways a novel about a girl who thought she was going to marry a boy someday, but then realized some bigger dreams, which is basically word for word one of Taylor's closing thoughts in 15. I thought I was going to marry him someday, but I realized some bigger dreams of mine.
Yes.
The language, says yes. I, is very subtle emotionally and just the words. Because when you're 15 and somebody tells you they love you, you're going to believe them. And when you're 15, feeling like there's nothing to figure out, well, count to 10, take it in. This is life before you know who you're going to be at 15. It's good writing.
It is good writing. It needs the melody behind it. I am terribly moved by hearing you recite part of Taylor's chorus, but that's because I've already heard Taylor sing and I know the melody. It needs the melody behind it. And I'm uncomfortable with pointing to it and saying and acting as if it does exactly the same thing that, let's say, William Butler Yeats does. It works differently because it needs that melody. But with the melody behind it, it's so good and so compact and does so much to help people make sense of experience that seems at once vastly incomprehensible and perfectly predictable. And it is in dialogue not only with literary traditions of female Bildungsroman, of stories about girls growing up to be who they're going to be, but it's also in this wonderfully subtle dialogue with the expectations we place around teenage romance, right? It neither fully accepts nor fully rejects the idea that you're going to get to go to the prom with your favorite guy. You might. It's okay to want that. What's not okay is to let it completely define you. It is so subtle in both accepting and moving past the conventionalized romantic expectations that many of us accept and want in our teens, even though some of us don't.
Are you hearing other literary echoes?
What Taylor is doing with representations of high school is historically specific. You don't get it before there are lots of free or low-cost high schools open to more than one gender. But you can find poems about negotiating boys and dating and sex and eroticism and homosocial friendships for heteroerotic girls. You can find them in contemporary poetry. You find them all over one of my favorite contemporary poets, Laura Kosciuszko. And that's why we're reading her in this class.
Let's take another song called Seven, going back even further in memory and childhood and a different sort of feeling.
Please picture me in the trees. I hid my peak at 7 feet in the swing over the creek. I was too scared to jump in.
MJ, this is going way back before high school. I think she's talking about a girl, 7 years old. Mm-hmm. What are you hearing?
One of the things this reminds me of is the excellent musical adaptation of Alison Bechdel's graphic novel Fun Home. It's possible that that's just because I'm from Pennsylvania, and so I get very excited. I'm like, Pennsylvania mentioned! But something about a childhood and swinging set in this place. There's also something. And again, I'm from Pennsylvania before we get any angry emails. So I understand that Pennsylvania is not the South, but there's something very almost Southern Gothic about this, both in the sort of moody instrumentation, a sort of wistfulness. Later in the song, there's sort of unspecified trauma, not Taylor's, but someone she's speaking to that's figured in terms of haunting. These sort of very archetypally sweet or innocent images mixed with this like deep moodiness. There's a real wistfulness and a real sort of undercurrent of almost gothic nostalgia to this song, right?
Yeah, and there's a kind of dark memory going back before boyfriends. She says, love you to the moon and to Saturn, passed down like folk songs. The love lasts so long, and I've been meaning to tell you, I think your house is haunted. Your dad is always mad. And that must be why, and I think you should come live with me and we can be pirates. Then you won't have to cry.
Or hide in the closet.
Or hide in the closet. And just like a folk song, our love will be passed on. Please picture me in the weeds. Before I learned civility, I used to scream ferociously anytime I wanted. I.
Taylor is also participating in an entirely other literary tradition. You know, 10 or 11 of them, honestly. But one of them, emotionally, thematically, is where the adult looks back at childhood and says, will things ever feel like that again? Will things ever be that beautiful again? Will I ever have that kind of comfort with an age mate, with a playmate, with a friend in my own body? Will I ever have those things again? And will there be, as Wordsworth says, abundant recompense? Will I get anything back in return for admitting that I'm no longer seven? Who knows whether Taylor intended this? We can't just call her up and ask her. But one of Wordsworth's most famous early poems is about a young child who is apparently unaware that there is a difference between the dead and the living. You remember that one? It's called We Are Seven. And wow. Wordsworth's sort of boneheaded adult narrator, Wordsworth regularly depicts himself in those early poems as just kind of a bumblehead, is sort of interrogating this girl who lives in an impoverished household. Several of her siblings have died. And she at one point had six siblings, and a couple of them are deceased. So the dummy Wordsworth keeps saying, but how many of them are you, as if you were a census taker? And the girl keeps saying, no, we are seven. Some of us are in heaven and some of us are here, but altogether we are seven. And the point of the poem, or one of the points of that poem, which is in ballad stanzas, you can sing them if you really want to. It is a lyrical ballad, as Wordsworth says. Part of the point of that poem is that a certain kind of childhood means that you regard the dead as just differently alive. And Wordsworth is asking us as adults who understand the irony there, are there still beautiful things? Are there still ways to live as if the dead were alive? Are there ways to keep that glow alive into self-conscious adulthood?
There's something kind of haunting. The Wordsworth poem is haunting partially because of the sometimes simple rhymes and the heaven, seven, right? And the simple childish assertion, no, sir, we are seven, this sort of repetitive childish insistence, the disjunct between that and how an adult would typically understand the situation, that's what creates this sort of deeply, deeply haunting atmosphere in this poem. And I think that some of the Taylor lines acquire that same sort of hauntedness, like we can go be pirates. That's something that an adult would not say to another adult usually. Right. It's something a child would say, but hearing it in this sort of retrospective voice from an adult woman is compelling. There's something compelling about someone in her late 20s or 30s at the time Folklore was written, singing, you can run away with me. I think your house is haunted. We can go be pirates. I love you to the moon and Saturn. These nearly childish tropes combined with the sense that you know she knows there's something more and something darker about the world.
Yeah.
Can I ask, is she aware of the what she's drawing from Wordsworth? Does it matter?
I don't know. I think there are certainly places where Taylor is aware of the literary references she's making. I don't know whether Taylor Swift has read all of Wordsworth. This is a relatively common Wordsworth line. I experienced it in high school in Pennsylvania, but I didn't go to the same high school as Taylor Swift.
One of the brilliant things about what she does as a songwriter is that the literary references are always extra. You often can't be sure whether she intends them, and you never need to get the literary reference in order to process the argument and the emotional power in the song. The references, if there are references, are always the icing and never the cake. And that is hard to pull off so consistently, and she does it.
Whether she knows Wordsworth or not, it's wonderful to feel that she's drawing on a deep mine of feeling in English poetry.
Yeah.
Should we be listening, looking, studying for this kind of literary antecedent references in all this work, MJ?
I don't think it's necessary, but it is certainly an element that you can look for in her lyrics. I think I'm less interested in whether Taylor read Wordsworth than in whether a student who reads both Taylor and Wordsworth can get something new out of that conjunction or can juxtapose them in interesting ways or can find resonances that either weren't intended or were, but it almost doesn't matter.
Yeah, resonances is the right word.
And that song is full of literal resonances. It's really echoey. The production on that song is so kind of marshy and echoey. It is as if the song were acoustically inviting us to seek out hidden resonances like the ones that MJ is describing.
Let's listen to a very famous song, All Too Well, a breakup song of which she's written many. People, of course, have studied the relationship that she's looking back on here. The language is intense. Hey, you call me up again just to break me like a promise. So casually cruel in the name of being honest. I'm a crumpled up piece of paper lying here because I remember it all too well. Place that in literature, Stephanie Burt.
Okay. You have asked for me to place it in locationally and visually specific breakup songs and breakup poems, and Thomas Hardy's Neutral Tones is the first one that comes to mind, one of the great breakup poems of the 19th century. It's where Hardy says of dead leaves in the winter, they had fallen from an ash and were gray, and just screws up the meter. We stood by a pond that winter day, and the sun was white as though chidden of God, and a few leaves lay on the starving sod. They had fallen from an ash and were gray. Now, that is a winter poem, not an autumn poem. But we are being asked to see specific leaves, colors, scenes as places that belong to a romance that is over. And now I want to go back to a breakup poem or a breakup song that's even closer to what Taylor is doing there, where she's going back to the moments when the relationship was great in order to talk about why it fell apart and how it fell apart and how vivid those moments from when it was going well remain. How much, I suppose we're in Wordsworth again, how much those spots of time adhere to Taylor's consciousness, how much they stick around, how firm those autumn colors are in her mind, even though the relationship's gone and the scarf's gone too, because Maggie Gyllenhaal presumably still has the scarf.
All Too Well was re-released as a 10-minute version. The 10-minute version gets a little more autobiographical. It drops really specific biting references. My favorite line from the 10-minute version is, I was never good at telling jokes, but the punchline goes, I'll get older, but your lovers stay my age.
Yeah. Taylor didn't make up that joke, but it's never been used effectively.
It's from Dazed and Confused, right? Or it's most famous in Dazed and Confused with a man saying that about high school girls. The thing I love about high school girls, you know, I get older, they stay the same age. I think it's so great that she took that from pop culture and just like wielded it like a knife straight into this guy's heart, you know?
I think my favorite line from the longer version, because of the role it plays in the way that she's teaching us as her listeners how to see the life course and how to regard our own changing selves and desires, is when her dad says it's supposed to be fun turning 21. And if you know the entire mythology of Taylor's life, which you do not have to enjoy the songs, it is another kind of icing, it's not the cake. You know that supposedly she had a birthday party where her older boyfriend of the time, this Hollywood actor, said he would show up and then he never shows up. And I believe he sent tons of flowers, but he just kind of was somewhere else. And of course, if your boyfriend doesn't show up to your birthday party, that's not really a relationship that you might feel you're getting everything you need from. And so she's miserable and her father says, and we've been in her house at that point in the song, as well as her sister's house. It's supposed to be fun turning 21. And then we start to think about how old she is and what's supposed to be happening and what her relationship is as this tremendously creative, autonomous figure. What her relationship is to the stage of life that she's at. There's a lot of beautiful literary devices going on in that song that are local. To break someone like a promise. That's a great figure of speech. But then that song points forward to her song 22, which she is going to write soon about how it's important to be 22 when you're 22 and go out because she didn't get to be 21 when she was 21 because she was to attach to this older guy who treated her like an accessory. Mm. I don't know if that's literary enough.
Right. And I think there's a reason that it's supposed to be fun turning 21 isn't in the version of the song that she releases at, what, 23?
Yeah.
Or so. There's not enough retrospectiveness there.
Yeah.
I don't know.
In 22, in the Folklore album, comes another one of Lost Romance called Cardigan. When I felt like I was an old cardigan under someone's bed, you put me on and said I was your favorite.
So, a couple things going on in that beautiful song, one of which is that it's got a relationship between words, texture, melody, and harmony that is different from the ones that we see pretty much throughout the first four albums, which has to do with the way that the song was written. The way that at least some of the Folklore songs worked, including that one, is that Aaron Dessner from The National sends Taylor a track, sends her a rhythm track, and says, play with this, you write the melody over it, you write the words, you make this track into a song. That's called track and hook songwriting. The critic Nate Sloan has written beautifully about the difference between track and hook songwriting and lyrics and music songwriting, where you start with a chord progression and a melody, which is the way country songwriting normally works. And there are lyrics and music songwriting pieces on Folklore, Betty, for example. But Cardigan really starts with the groove. And that gives Taylor a good deal of freedom to do what she wants to do with the lyrics and the melody, to diverge more from this track that's operating texturally, independently, with this piano that's almost a drone. One of the things that she is doing, and this honestly goes back to You Belong With Me, to what should a healthy romantic relationship look like? What do you want? One of the things she's doing is saying that the kind of lover that she wants, and the kind of lover that many of us want, and if we're lucky, get, will say to us and show us physically, as well as in words, that we're not just familiar and comfortable, we're also someone's favorite. You can be someone's favorite, you can be close to their skin, even if you're familiar and comfortable and more like an old cardigan than like, for example, high heels on cobblestones, which are really hard to walk in. I've tried and I can't. And that goes right back to how You Belong With Me sort of says prospectively what Cardigan says retrospectively, which is a healthy romance is friendship plus smooching. It's not instead of friendship. And it can last. Our love can last long.
But there's also something past tense about this song.
Yeah.
It's I knew you. It's not I know you. You are here right now. I'm kissing you tonight on the High Line. It's I knew you.
Yeah.
I knew you'd come back. I knew you would come back, but it's in this sort of strange past future hypothetical tense where this person hasn't come back, or maybe they did and it ended anyway. It's all sort of this past tense foreclosed thing, and it's melancholy for that reason.
Yes.
You asked earlier about literary references. I mean, there's a Peter Pan reference in that song about Peter losing Wendy because Wendy grows up and leaves.
That's what that is.
And leaves okay. Neverland. And does it matter to your emotional experience of the song that you didn't know that? Does it matter to the probably half of the undergraduates in the course who don't know who Peter Pan is? Maybe
better
who know
to
who
know
Peter Pan
Peter
is.
Peter and Wendy never dawned on me.
I tried to change the ending, Peter losing Wendy. It's about Peter Pan who stays stuck in this idealized world for him while Wendy grows up and moves on.
Stays the same age.
Right.
Other names that you've associated with this history go back to Alexander Pope, but also as recently as Robert Frost. Weave them into, again, the family heritage that she's drawing on.
Do you want to do Frost and I'll do Pope?
I think that would be wise.
I think that would be very wise.
She references The Road Not Taken in a song, "Tis the Damn Season." "The Road Not Taken Looks Real Good Now." I think she references it again in an earlier song as well, one that wasn't maybe as popular as "Tis the Damn Season." So it's sort of a recurring trope for her. She has those. Not all of them are literary references. This one is. Even if you didn't read "The Road Not Taken" in AP English or elsewhere, it's in the culture, right? It's somewhat accessible, maybe. She references
Scarlet. And the last line, "and it has made all the difference."
Right. "And that has made all the difference." For Frost, it's unclear whether that's a true thing that we should actually think about Rhodes, or whether it's something that this sort of speaker character is feeling about the road. It doesn't make a difference, right?
Right, it doesn't make a difference. That's right.
We don't actually know whether or not it makes a difference. I don't think Taylor is using it that way. It's one of those things where maybe knowing Frost adds that little extra bit of resonance. Certainly, I think they can be like usefully juxtaposed, but also someone who hasn't read The Scarlet Letter or hasn't read The Road Not Taken will still enjoy the song, even if they don't get 110% of the references. Staying at my parents' house, and the road not taken looks real good now. Time flies, messy as the mud on your truck tires. Now I'm missing your smile. Hear me out, we could just ride around, and the road not taken looks real good now. And it always another type of comparison we can make the Taylor references Frost. Taylor may or may not reference Wordsworth, and then we can make the reading Swift next to Swift, or reading Swift next to Pope, or Swift next to Hopkins is useful and productive for us, her audience,
right,
or her scholars.
Right.
Find the trail back to Alexander Pope,
yeah.
Stephanie.
So Pope, who was the most famous poet in England in the early 18th century, had a problem. A couple of problems. Despite being super famous and successful and able to live off the sale of his own books, which was quite rare for a poet, one of his problems was that everybody wanted his attention. Another problem he had was that he was famous partly for writing beautiful pastoral poetry. His big earliest success was called Windsor Forest, poems that, you know, no one could object to. But he became as famous as he was partly for writing satires, for attacking other writers and political figures who, as Taylor says, did bad things, who were hypocrites, who were mean to him sometimes. And he got embroiled in what we would now call flame wars.
Hmm.
And Pope writes a poem that is about how he deals with the liars and the haters and the low-down, dirty, dirty cheats, as Taylor said. And it is a poem about how Pope has learned to shake it off.
I mean, she's almost summoning Alexander Pope.
She is summoning a spirit that is consonant with what Pope is doing in that poem. I don't want to pretend I can read her mind. I don't know if she's read Pope. I'd love to believe it. She and Pope both have something in common with a third form, which we haven't talked about yet, which is hip hop, where you've got a trained dramatic person saying the words and you've got musical accompaniment, but you're using a form of delivery that is not principally melodic and you can get a lot more words in and you've got more flexible couplets. And there's quite a lot of hip hop that is engaged in these kinds of battles of who's right, who's got right on their side, who's got their friends on their side, who shot first, metaphorically. Pope has a lot in common with a certain strand of battling hip hop, which the song Shake It Off in particular alludes to without being. Taylor knows that she is not going to make a rap album or write a poem in 18th century couplets.
Stephanie and MJ, make that connection back to Gerard Manley Hopkins, the famous Pied Beauty poem, which lots of people know, but also because he was specifically a religious man and a religious poet.
I don't know that Hopkins' sense that the Christian Trinity authorizes the beauty of nature or the beauty of childhood is at all present in Taylor's work. When Taylor mentions God, and she does, it is in a different way and in a somewhat more conventional way. But Hopkins's interest in how we experience beauty, in how that is different for children and for adults, shows up repeatedly in Taylor's songs. We saw it in the song 7 earlier. We see it at the beginning of, and again at the end of, one of Taylor's great early songs, The Best Day, where she says early on that at 5, she doesn't know why the leaves change in the fall. And then later in the end of the song, she says, now I know why the leaves change in the fall. And what she has learned in that song is that her mom is really, really good at being a mom, not only loves her, but knows how to be a good mom, which is honestly a set of technical skills and life choices, as well as a set of feelings. And Gerard Manley Hopkins repeatedly, in the poem that we use for that is Spring and Fall, which is subtitled To a Young Child, that is addressed to a child named Margaret who does not know why the leaves change in the fall. And Hopkins says, Margaret, are you grieving over Golden Grove on leaving? And Hopkins, who feels very much alone and unsupported by family in the couplets of that poem by the end, says that Margaret is weeping ultimately because we're all going to die. It is the plight man was born for. It is Margaret you mourn for. And you hope he's not telling Margaret that she's going to die. I assume he doesn't. He just goes home and writes that poem for adults to read. And Taylor starts from the same experience of seeing leaves that fall in the autumn, knowing as an adult, or honestly, when she writes The Best Day, a teenager, but as not a young child. Taylor knows, and a young child does not know why the leaves change. And the answer is what I would call the second law of thermodynamics. It's entropy. It's that all things, as Frost says, run down and nothing gold can stay. But Taylor is able to turn that sentiment, that sadness of things we know that children don't know, around, not by appealing to God, but by appealing to Andrea Swift, who is a very good mom.
Daddy's smart and you're the prettiest lady in the whole wide world. Now I know why all the trees change in the fall. I know you were on my side.
MJ?
Hopkins is one of my favorite poets. I don't think I like Taylor Swift for the same reasons I like Gerard Manley Hopkins. I like him for the ways he's absolutely at the edge of the English language, trying to wrench it into shapes that make sense, both directly theologically for him and as a way of dealing with his like deep personal agony. I don't know what Taylor's private journals look like, but I think Taylor is always writing for an audience that is much larger than Hopkins ever intended his audience to be, although now he's beloved by many. I think he should be beloved by more.
We're working on it, partly by teaching this class, but
we're working on it.
You're telling us stuff that nobody has tapped into about
really?
This amazing phenomenon. I want to change the pace entirely around a very different sort of song and lyric. It's called The Last Great American Dynasty. It's a digression on a real woman, apparently, who owned the house that she bought in Rhode Island.
Yep.
A very rich woman who did what she wanted to do.
Yeah.
Rebecca rode up on the afternoon train. It was sunny. Her salt box house on the coast took a mind off St. Louis. Bill was the heir to the Standard Oil name and money, and the town said, how did a middle class divorcee do it? The wedding was charming, if a little gauche, there's only so far new money goes. They picked out a home and called it Holiday
shades of Newport, Gatsby maybe, Kennedy's.
Yeah. She is taking us to a tradition of thinking about houses and money and who belongs where. And if you're in sort of a bad mood or you're thinking about economic justice, you're thinking what Raymond Williams thought about houses like this, which is they should all just become public libraries. But if you are in a more sympathetic mood, you are thinking where the song invites you to go. And if you participate in the consciousness the song invites you to join, you're thinking about who belongs where, about how it feels. And there's so much autobiography in this song, so much of Taylor telling a certain slice of her own story, even before you get to the last line, and then it was bought by me. How does it feel to show up in a place of immense privilege and get told you don't belong? How does it feel then to have so much economic or cultural power that if you want, you can wreck the place? How does it feel to want to wreck the place? How does it feel to regard the place, and this is explicit in the song, as a kind of monument to patriarchy and fill it with ballet and fill it with decadence and fill it with things that seem honestly campy?
Say she was seen on occasion pacing the rock, staring out at the midnight sea, and in a feud with her neighbor she stole his dog and died at Key Lime Green. 50 years is a long time. Holiday house sat quietly on that beach, free of women with madness, the men in bad habits, and then it was bought by me. If I never showed up, what could have been?
Taylor is inviting us, and this is a song that is relatable in some ways because who among us has not felt out of place? But it is much more obviously aspirational. Imagine feeling out of place and then getting the power to wreck the place. And to wreck the place not in a spirit of sort of punk rock anger. Punk rock is great, but that's not what Taylor's doing. Wrecking the place in a spirit of fun and in a spirit of creating a community that was not available to you earlier in your life because you did not have the resources to create it. That's what the heiress in the song is doing. And that's what I think Taylor is aspiring on a different and perhaps less material level to create among her fans. You didn't grow up with this kind of community. I'm going to bring it to you. I can't fill your pool with champagne, but I can be the kind of star who encourages the internet to sprout a constellation where you might find your new best friend halfway across the country and spend hours getting to know each other while decoding my songs. It's about Taylor using her cultural and economic power to reject an older kind of self-perpetuating, literally patriarchal community and to build a new one.
MJ?
I think Taylor Swift fans would kind of get the parallel. New money, judged by people around her, does these scandalous things and gets all this negative attention. Obviously, the fans listening are already thinking about her, but I think it's clever how she saves that twist for the end. But she doesn't leave it out either. This isn't purely a sort of narrative poem about someone else and you read into it. She does give you that twist, that slight reworking of the chorus. She had a marvelous time ruining everything. I had a marvelous time ruining everything. We already knew it was about her, but she really does drive that point home once you're already kind of invested in this parallel story.
Yes. Right? Yes.
MJ, kind of, I want you to delve into the name that we haven't mentioned yet, Sylvia Plath, and the lecture that you're going to give in this wonderful course on Taylor Swift's connection.
Okay. So I think the reason Sylvia Plath is compelling to many, many, many people, most especially maybe young teen girls and young women, is that there's this deeply taboo sense of madness stemming both from the sort of tragic facts of her biography and the incredibly transgressive nature of her lyrics, transgressive both for the time they were written and published and now, sometimes for different reasons. And I think it would be a shame if we talked about madness and femininity and the sort of ways in which one can be a mad woman or a transgressive and therefore both appealing and intimidating and despised figure, which we talk about when we talk about certain eras of Taylor Swift. It would be a shame if we didn't have Sylvia Plath in the room, at least partially. So I'm interested in that. I'm interested in madness. I'm interested in the viscerality of certain lines of Sylvia Plath. I'm also, I think, really interested in one particular Sylvia Plath poem, which is a villanelle.
What's she saying?
Probably the most famous villanelle in English literary history is "Do not go gentle into that good night, rage, rage against the dying of the light." Those two lines rhyme with each other. They come back to end different stanzas, and then they come together at the end. Sylvia Plath has a villanelle, Mad Girl's love song, that has, "I shut my eyes and all the world drops dead. I think I made you up inside my head." I kind of just want to teach 200 students what a villanelle is, and this seems like a really good way to do that. I'm interested in the way poems use form, right, which can include those sort of interwoven rhyming lines. And I'm interested in the way that poems work. Not to say that poems work like songs work. I don't think they do. But I think students who have been thinking for several months about how songs work, about how choruses work, about how repetition works in music, will maybe be slightly more amenable to hearing about how formal poetry works, how repetition in poetry works. And that's something that is not necessarily going to bring students in off the street during normal occasions. I'm kind of fascinated by that. I'm still brainstorming, but I want to kind of like make students write a villanelle or pick out a line that would make a good villanelle foundation or maybe work with each other. I don't know whether that will actually work with the course, but I kind of want to do something like that. We've already talked about how reading Wordsworth or reading Hopkins can help us understand Taylor Swift, but I think there are ways that knowing quite a lot about Taylor Swift can help us understand other things, formal, kind of traditionally styled poems.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, very much so.
Sum it up in a sense. What is Taylor Swift hearing in Sylvia Plath? And what is Sylvia Plath hearing in the some sort of recapitulation of ideas and forms in Taylor Swift?
Taylor Swift and Sylvia Plath have both faced a lot of vitriol and contempt for a type of deviance that is inextricable from their femininity, from their gender, from the way they are treated by men, both romantically and men in the world. There's a mad girl, mad woman connection, I think, that both of them have.
Would you say that they end up in the tortured poets department?
Isn't that funny? We didn't mention, but that's going to be the title of her new album.
I mean, who is more tortured than Sylvia Plath, right? Of the tortured poets. There's something very emotional about the torture that she talks about as a tortured poets department, right? We're not talking about physical torture. We're talking about a very loaded use of a term to mean a level of emotional anguish.
Right.
You know, Sylvia Plath did not directly endure the Holocaust and uses it somewhat controversially, and we'll talk about the controversy there in the class, uses it to deal with her own sort of personal, familial, psychoanalytic agonies.
I'm hoping and expecting that the title Tortured Poets Department has some levity about it, and that one of the things, among many others, that Taylor will be doing with her set of new songs is mocking people who see her as always tortured and sad and depressed and angry and whatever, mocking that stereotype in the way that she does a little bit in The Last Great American Dynasty, because that heiress who owned that house on Watch Hill before Taylor did had fun. She had fun with it. She had fun with the tropes that she invoked. And I think Taylor's going to have fun with those tropes too.
Stephanie Burt, MJ Cunniff, we've had a lot of fun listening to a Taylor Swift I'd never heard of before. I think she'd want to take the course.
She's welcome to audit.
She can drop by whenever she wants.
She's been right there.
Are you saying that she belongs with us?
Sure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stephanie Burt is professor of English at Harvard University and the author of Don't Read Poetry. MJ Cunniff is a PhD candidate in literature at Brown University. Here at Open Source, we depend on listener support. If you haven't done your part yet, seize the moment now. Visit radioopensource.org/donate and pitch in to keep the world's first and longest running podcast going strong. Open Source is proud to be a member of Hub and Spoke, a Boston-based collective of independent, creator-owned podcasts. Our shows range from history to politics to art to technology. We come together around the principle that independent voices are more important now than ever. You can learn more at hubspokeaudio.org.
Hub and Spoke. Audio Collective.